I used to call certain foods certain things to put myself off them. So I used to call cow's milk cow's pus so that I didn't drink it. And I used to call eggs chicken periods so that I didn't eat them. I would go to extreme lengths to put myself off eating them. Yeah. Because I was so fearful of what they would do to my body.
Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castagnini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's show. I love when you guys tune in, whether you are a first-time guest or someone who's been listening for a while. I really want to welcome you to the show. Thank you, thank you. I do this show just for you. And I know you've heard me talk about BMI before, if you've listened before. I have a lot to say about it, but today our guest really has had an experience with it, and so I'm really excited to have her on. We've talked about numbers on here too, and we've really been taught that a number can define our health. That goes without saying. We've been told that if your BMI falls into the quote unquote healthy range, you're doing something right. But again, I think that number, again, I could go off, but for any of you out there who still believe that, what if that number's lying? What if the time that you are most praised for being quote unquote healthy was actually when you were the most unwell? I want anyone out there who still believes in the BMI to really be challenged today. And my guest today, Zoe Hardwood, knows that truth firsthand. As a former dancer turned eating disorder recovery and body image coach, Zoe spent years in a culture that celebrated thinness and discipline. And doctors told her missing period and low heart rate were just part of being an athlete. I had a guest on in a previous episode just recently, and we talked about this thing and just this thing. So this is, again, someone who's coming on here talking about how missing a period was just a part of being an athlete, part of fitness. But behind the praise was exhaustion, fear, and she'll talk about this, orthorexia. And again, she'll talk more about that, disguised as wellness. And it wasn't until her body changed, until she sat outside of the quote-unquote healthy BMI range, that her blood work, energy, and life came back. And the irony was that she was finally healthy when medicine said she wasn't. And again, she's going to get way more into this. And we're going to talk about how BMI hides more than it reveals, how quote-unquote clean eating can spiral into obsession, and really what real health looks like when you stop letting numbers define it. If you've ever been told that your body was healthy or quote-unquote fine, I put those in quotations, but something inside of you really knew otherwise, this episode will really validate that voice for you and help you to trust your body again. So really excited to get Zoe on. I saw her on Instagram. I saw her post and I reached out to her. I said, oh my gosh, I got to get you on here. So anyway, really excited to get her on. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. All right, Zoe, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I'm really excited to talk to you today because I really have a lot of thoughts and opinions on the BMI, the medical field, and this idea of quote unquote what's healthy or not. And I'd love to hear a little bit about like your experience and where, how you got into doing the work you're doing. Would you mind sharing a little bit about just that?
Yeah, of course. So I like to say in a previous life, I was a dancer. So I started dancing from the age of two. And when I left school, I took over my mum's dance school. She had it for 10 years. I had it for a further 20. I battled with my body and with food through the whole of my adult life, but I wasn't really aware of it, and it was never brought to anybody's attention, so I fell under the radar, if you like. I must have had some kind of inkling though, because it was really important to me that my students never had an issue with their body. So we were what I like to call a holistic dance school. So we nurtured not only their dance skill, but also their emotional well-being and their mental well-being, their spiritual well-being. It just nurturing them holistically was really important to me. So then I guess when I was about 27, I'd had like different disordered eating patterns from the age of 17. But when I was about 27, my auntie came to the family and she said that we have hereditary heart issues in our family. So we all needed to watch our cholesterol. She'd been put on statins, and so we all needed to make sure that we avoided that same thing. And something just clicked in my head. And overnight, I found what I found to be the lowest saturated fat diet. So I went on a whole food plant-based diet overnight because I just had a fear that I was either going to have a heart attack or get cancer. And so I ate very clean for, quote unquote clean, for 7 years. I was still dancing full time, and I went to the doctors because I'd started missing my period. Had no suspicion that it was anything to do with food. And they said to me that my slow heart rate, poor circulation, very low blood pressure, and lack of menstrual cycle was because I was an athlete, and so it should be expected. And I never consistently lost my period. I'd have it and then I wouldn't have it for 2 months, and then I'd have it for a couple of months and then I didn't have it. So I just went through years of randomly having it, went back to the doctors, asked the same thing again, and they said the same thing again: you're an athlete, it's normal for you to not have a menstrual cycle. And I had my child also during this. Must have caught pregnant in the months that I did have my period, and then it carried on for the first couple of years of his life, first few years of his life actually, until 4 years ago. And with the dance school, because I really enjoyed the coaching side of it, I branched off and did coaching alongside the dance school as well. And for some reason, I think the universe was doing its thing, I was calling in like young girls with eating disorders. And I never advertised myself as an eating disorder recovery coach. I was always like a life coach. And I just was calling in girl after girl with eating disorders. And it highlighted so much to me about my own eating patterns. And I realized that's what I'd been living with for years. And I became, and still am, an expert by experience for our NHS over here in the UK now, for the eating disorder services. Recently done some staff training on what it's like to live with an eating disorder and postpartum, through pregnancy and postpartum with an eating disorder. And now I coach purely eating disorders and body image issues. And I passed the dance school on to one of my teachers so that she could carry on the ethos of the dance school. Oh. Yeah, that's me.
Wow, so thank you for sharing that. And I have so many questions. first of all, amazing that you had a holistic approach to the dance school, because I know I've heard so many dancers say that they had the opposite and it was very toxic and promoted a lot of eating disorder behavior and so much hatred and shame of their bodies. And so wow, your dancers must have had a very different experience. And that's amazing.
Thank you.
But you said you had a different experience too yourself before you took over. So can you talk a little bit about that? What was different for you?
Growing up in the dance industry, as you would expect in the dance industry, that smaller bodies are better bodies, that you won't succeed, you won't achieve anything, you won't be accepted if you're not in a smaller body. I remember when I was doing my teacher training, and one of I was probably around about 25 at that age, and they had students, like their eldest students in the dance school were also doing their teaching qualifications as well. And one of the girls, she was probably about 15, 16. She said to the principal, I won't say the principal's name, but she was like, Miss, I'm on this diet and I'm going to try and get to this weight and I'm doing it by cutting out this. And the principal was just like, Kelly, that's amazing. Like, really supportive, really encouraged it. And she absolutely did not need to be losing any weight. She was a ballet dancer and had the body composition of a ballet dancer. And it just broke my heart. And I just thought, this is just, it's not right. It's not okay. And I think that's why I was so determined to make sure that our girls and our boys were so appreciative of what their bodies did for them and really moved into that body appreciation mindset.
It makes me sad because I'm just thinking they must have needed so much fuel and nutrition just to do all of that dancing.
Yeah.
And to just be in that mentality, especially I'm imagining some of them were going through puberty or really young and their bodies needed all of that to promote all the changes and growth. And yeah. Here they are thinking, oh, I have to be in a deficit and shrink my body and eat less. And I'm just wondering, do you think that they weren't fueling themselves enough?
I didn't see the result of the diet, so I couldn't say for her specifically, but it's very much encouraged even within your professional dance companies. If they want somebody to, they always use the language of lengthen out. Well, obviously, you can't lengthen. What they mean is they want you to slim down so that you look as though you've lengthened. And they will quite happily get dietitians and nutritionists in and put these full-time dancers on diets that are under 1,000 calories a day, and they're going to be burning at least three times more than that.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's, I think there are like gentle movements happening within the industry now. Ian McKay, who is the director of Royal Ballet in the UK, has recently, I think over the summer, announced that he was going to start having more diverse bodies on stage and within the dance companies, which was music to my ears. Mm. And from next September, they also wouldn't be accepting full-time dancers in year 7 and year 8 here over here. That's like 11 to 13 years old. They wouldn't be accepting full-time dancers, which again, I think is amazing because too often we see 20, 25-year-olds still in prepubescent bodies because they just cannot develop with the amount of strain that their bodies are under.
Oh my gosh. That's encouraging. So
yeah,
hopefully, fingers crossed. That's great news to my ears too.
Yeah.
It's interesting too. I've heard this so many times of doctors saying to athletes, yes, the things that you were experiencing, instead of there being alarm bells or red flags raised, it's like almost promoting, oh, yeah, you're an athlete. This is what happens to bodies when you work out so much or you were training. And I don't know, what was the message you heard? Was it like, oh, I'm just, this is healthy. This is what happens when you have a quote unquote healthy body.
Absolutely, completely normalized. And I don't really think a lot has changed now. I'm working with a ballet dancer now who her doctor said to her, oh, I expected your BMI to be lower than that as you're a ballet dancer. And it's just, Oh, I know. And also don't expect to have a period if you're a ballet dancer. And it's not just in the dance industry. It's just in any kind of athlete. Just because something's common, it doesn't mean it's normal. And if anybody isn't having a regular period for whatever reason, it needs to be investigated. So I would love there to be more awareness for GPs and doctors to know that it's not okay and that we do need to be having curiosity around why somebody might have lost their period.
No, I remember growing up with that too, just hearing, oh, they must not have their period because they're so active, they're an athlete, and it's like a good thing, almost. Mm-hmm. That's just what happens.
Yeah, my eating habits were never questioned, ever, when I went to the doctors. And I do wonder, even if they had have been, I feel like maybe they might have been praised anyway, rather than questioned, because it was orthorexia for me rather than a restrictive diet. I obviously was restricting, but not in a way that I think would have raised alarm bells. I think because it was all very clean food, there were no animal products. It was, like I say, a whole food, plant-based. I don't think it would have been queried. And because my body naturally just would never have gone underweight. So no matter how much weight I lost when I was poorly, I never went into the underweight part of the BMI scale, if you like. I sat just above it in healthy weight range. That's another reason why I was never questioned, because I was quote unquote healthy. And yet when I recovered, so within the last 4 years, I've been in overweight and have recently been through all of the tests for adenomyosis and endometriosis. And for that, I had to have all of my bloods done, and my bloods came back perfect. And that's me in overweight, so technically unhealthy. And so I think this is why the BMI scale really needs to be questioned and challenged, because when I'm healthy, technically by the BMI scale, I'm unhealthy. And yet when I'm ill, I'm technically healthy by the BMI scale.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
It's like, the biggest measure is this. I'm sorry, I've spoken so much about the BMI. We need to get rid of it. But this is such a powerful measure. And it's like, it's over and beyond everything else. And
yeah,
it's to your point, like really looking at the signs and the symptoms, how you're feeling, how your body's functioning, what you're eating, like all the things. But no, let's just base it on weight stigma, weight bias, BMI, like that's the be all end all to say you're quote unquote healthy or not, or what doctors give you as advice to, or tell you what to do to get within that range, and not even asking you like, what are you eating?
Yeah. And gatekeeping any kind of healthcare until you've fallen into what they deem as healthy.
And I think orthorexia, unfortunately, it's not in our diagnostic manual, but I think we all talk about it. It goes so far under the radar because it does on the surface appear, oh, they're just being like health conscious. They're being so quote unquote healthy. And it's almost like, how can anyone say, oh, this is the quote unquote bad thing to do? Because I think to your point, it starts out with almost this motivation of I'm trying to prevent illness or disease. Or so I'm wondering, did anyone even pick up on that? Or had you ever heard of orthorexia before?
No, I had no idea what it was. And I think it's so wrapped up in wellness culture now, and has been really. I went through this round about 2014, which is when the fruitarian craze was going on. Can you remember that?
Yep.
And so it was that for me, was cutting out all animal products, my diet mainly being fruit. Not many grains, but I was never scared of grains because they weren't animal products. And in my head, that was going to cause inflammation, that was going to cause the cancer and the heart attacks. Mm. But I also think I felt like I'd found the missing piece not long ago when I heard that orthorexia should also be viewed as an obsessive compulsive disorder. And that felt for me like the missing piece of the puzzle. That resonated so much because mine went way beyond food. It was for me toiletries. So everything had to be natural with my toiletries. Household products. I wouldn't clean the house with anything unless I'd made it myself. And also medication. I wouldn't take anything unless it was natural, because I had somehow convinced myself, with a little bit of help of social media, that all of these things were going to make me really ill. And so that obsessive compulsion went way beyond food.
Wow. So you brought up the social media part. I'm wondering, the more you saw like articles or posts or things about that, did you just get more and more of that? And again, I get down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, okay. It was, my whole algorithm was fruitarians and plant-based diet. And for me, it snowballed. So it was whole food plant-based to begin with. And then I experimented with like raw till four, which raw food till 4 o'clock. And then it was like liquid raw, and it just, and then that the alkaline diet, which cut out even more. And this was all because of stuff that I was seeing, like scaremongering on social media of what would happen if you didn't eat this way. And I genuinely did do it for what I thought was for my health.
Can you talk a little bit about that? What happened? Like, what did you experience when you started to take on this very restrictive, very obsessive way of living your life and eating, and even the house cleaning products and lotions and things? Like, what did you feel like during all that?
My mum always used to say to me, because we worked together, we had the dance school, she always used to say that I was like short-tempered, but she probably got the brunt of it because I obviously couldn't do that as a teacher. Mm. And I think that was because I was malnourished and just so hungry. Mm. Sorry, can you ask the question again? What was...
Oh, yeah, I was just wondering that I've seen these posts too, and it seems like, oh, you're going to feel so much better and it's going to make you like improve your life. So I'm wondering, did you actually feel that way, or what did you actually feel? Like, what was going on?
No, absolutely not. I think the only thing that I felt, and I don't have shame in saying this now, but I definitely would have at the time, was that I felt superior because I felt like I had the secret hack to health and longevity that nobody else either had the discipline to stick to, or they didn't know what it was. And so I just felt like I had something special that nobody else had or knew about, because people would say to me all the time, oh, can I have some smoothie recipes? And can I have some inspiration for this and for this? And I used to love that. I really felt like I was helping people, but I actually think that I probably encouraged a lot of disordered eating in my close friends around that time. And I have apologized for that, because I do recognize that now. But yeah, I think it was a feeling of superiority, but definitely no health improvements at all. Like the complete opposite.
So it's interesting, as you were saying that, did you feel like that was part of like your identity and your worth was like, oh, I'm the quote healthy one, the one everyone comes to, and right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. But I also, just as a psychologist, I'm thinking like, I'm wondering if the superiority was almost like necessary to keep you doing these things, because that must have been like almost miserable, like hard. Yeah.
I'm a Cornish girl. Seafood was a huge part of my upbringing. I used to go to the chip shop and all I would buy is a jar of cockles. Like, I love fish. And giving that up was the hardest thing for me. And it took a lot of willpower to not eat it. And it's the thing that I eat the most of now, because I'm just so happy to have it back. And I love seafood so much. So yeah, you really go against what you want and you do what you think is right. Because yeah, there is not only that little voice in your head, but all of the external voices on social media saying that it is the right thing to do.
So did you start fearing certain foods too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I used to call certain foods certain things to put myself off them. So I used to call cow's milk cow's pus so that I didn't drink it. And I used to call eggs chicken periods so that I didn't eat them. I would go to extreme lengths to put myself off eating them. Yeah. Because I was so fearful of what they would do to my body.
Okay. Interesting. Oh, gosh. Okay. I'm actually curious, too. Did your world get smaller as, like, you got more restrictive with what you could eat or what you could do?
Yes, definitely. Because this was before vegan was, like, the vegan diet was just a normalized thing. It was very early days of veganism just being part of society. So there was very little to eat. It was usually just chips, and then it would be, what if they've cooked that in the same oils as they've cooked meat, so wouldn't have chips. So eating out really became a problem. And I think my auntie out of everybody noticed it, because I didn't see her very often. So when I did see her, and eating out with her really became a problem. And I was the only person that was vegan. And again, I have made peace with this now, but I had my little boy in the middle of all of this. Mm. And I didn't want to be the only vegan. So I told my little boy at the time that we were vegan for ethical reasons, which I wasn't, but I wanted him to be vegan with me. And I now have learnt that he's autistic. So he is very black and white, right and wrong thinking. Mm. And he is still vegan and now won't come away from it, because too much guilt of what that does to the animals. And I hold a lot of guilt for that, because I did that to make me feel better. So yeah, that's been part of the healing as well.
Oh, I'm sorry you're feeling guilty. Gosh, just eating disorders just wreak havoc, don't they?
Yeah.
Gosh, like, I'm just even thinking, like, how did you handle pregnancy? Like,
yeah, so
restrictive.
I spent most of it in hospital because I had hyperemesis, which is really normal with an eating disorder. So I would have a few days in hospital, and then they would send me home for a couple of days. But because I didn't want to take the medication because I was scared of it, then I'd land up back in hospital again. And I was just on this cycle through pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And I only recently realized that hyperemesis is closely linked with eating disorders. And again, something that I think should be on midwives' radars. Just be curious as to, people get hyperemesis anyway, but just be curious as to why somebody might. And then when Rex was born, he was born with an Apgar of 2, which again, low Apgars are really common when you've been living with an eating disorder through pregnancy. But I do remember Rex's dad coming into my room, and it just so happened that my consultant was in there at the time. And he came in with 2 green smoothies, because that's what I'd asked him to bring. And the consultant said, you can't drink those anymore. You need to be having things like Fanta, Ribena, like lots of high sugar. And that horrified me. That was so scary, to be told that I had to put that kind of stuff into my body. And I didn't do it. And it just landed me back in hospital regularly.
For people who maybe don't know what the signs and symptoms are for why you were hospitalized, could you talk a little bit about that? Like, how did you know you needed to be hospitalized?
So my best friend was a midwife, and I was being really sick. So she was always checking up on me, seeing how I was. And I was being sick, but I was being sick regularly. And she was like, what have you kept down today? And I had a bottle of water, and I took a bottle of the water, a picture of the bottle of water. And there was just this tiny bit that had gone. And she said, is that all you've managed to keep down? And I was like, yeah, just thinking it was morning sickness. And she was like, you need to go into A&E. And they did get me through straight away. I didn't have to wait. They put me straight on cyclozine through a drip, which is anti-sickness, and on saline drips. And that was my cycle. But it was just not being able to keep anything down. And when the cravings got the better of me, sometimes I had rice pudding and 2 things. One, I managed to keep it down. But 2, it just felt incredible to eat something that was substantial and not something that I'd eaten for so long. But yeah, I would say just continual vomiting and not even being able to keep down water, those are the red flags that you need to be seen.
Oh my gosh, you must have felt so miserable.
Yeah.
Physically. Wow.
Yeah.
And then just to hear the fear postpartum, like, how did you manage that? Because I'm wondering, like, your body needed so much to recover from giving birth.
So much. I should have had a blood transfusion, but my best friend delivered Rex. So she was going to be my birthing partner anyway, but because they were short-staffed on midwives when we got in, she said, can I clock on? Can I deliver? So she delivered Rex, which was beautiful, and she was absolutely incredible and such a support. But after, so Rex's Apgars were 2, he was taken away from me. I didn't see him for the first 20 minutes. And she said to me in that time, you need to have a blood transfusion. And I was like, I can't, because again, in my head, it was like contaminating. It was something that wasn't mine in my body. And she said, so we're on iron tablets. And I was like, again, I don't know how she was still my friend. I was like, I can't take iron tablets. I was like, can you just trust me to get my iron up on my own? And she knew me, and obviously we were checking in all the time, and she was like, I'm going to give you till this date, and if we don't get up, then you're going on the iron tablets. And so I was like, fair compromise. And I did it as obsessively and naturally, but obsessively. And it was my sole focus to get my iron up rather than being on my child. So it was everything green, all of the green smoothies, all of the green food, obviously no red meat because that wasn't an option for me. Spartone, just everything that I could possibly do to get my iron up naturally and not have any medical intervention. So yeah, it was intense in those first couple of weeks.
Oh my gosh. I hope you're kinder to yourself now. And yeah. I can hear the way you speak. It's almost like this, oh, this angst. But I'm just wondering, as you were going through that, you like, do you remember what you were just so afraid of when you were being told, like, a blood infusion, the iron? Was it just that you were going to do harm to your body by actually doing things that your body needed?
Yeah, it was thinking, again, that superiority that I was talking about, again, thinking that I knew better than them, that they were trying to contaminate me and corrupt my body with their evidence-based medication and my social media-based information, and just thinking that I knew what was right for my body and sadly being wrong.
Again, that's part of the illness, right? It's so mm-hmm. obsessive, and you have all these rules and things that you think are right, and to deviate is so anxiety-provoking, right? And mm-hmm. it's the irony of, like, you're trying to do something good for your body and maintain health, yeah. But the double-edged sword of that is you're doing exactly the thing you're fearing, is you're actually making yeah. yourself sick and creating a state of unhealth in your body, which is awful.
Yeah, it's really conflicting. And then when you start to realize that, oh, I don't actually think this is right, I don't think I have got this right, to then have the courage to introduce those foods that you're so scared of. And almost for me, having an actual vision of my arteries clogging up as I'm eating the fish, as I'm eating the eggs, but pushing through it anyway, I think that's the hardest part, is that, like, that first year mm-hmm. of just doing it anyway, feeling the fear and doing it anyway.
So what was that turning point for you where you're like, okay, I'm realizing, like, I need to switch something up. I need to start eating more things. What did something happen, or, like, how did you get to that point?
So I don't think I ever had a, oh my gosh, I have an eating disorder moment, okay. But I met my partner, and maybe wrongly, because I had my little boy in the middle of it, but I realized, I think for the first time, that there was life outside of what I was eating. Mm. And I had never experienced that, certainly in over the last 7 years, hadn't experienced that. And I just realized that if I took my focus away from my food a little bit, my world got bigger. And so it wasn't a light bulb moment. It was just a realization of, there's more to life than what I'm eating. And so that was when I started introducing the animal products again, and being scared, but knowing that meant that I didn't have to think so much about what I was eating. All of a sudden, cooking and creating food and meals just became so much easier, because there were so many more options for me to eat. And I wasn't always going down rabbit holes of trying to make food exciting with the few ingredients that I was using. So I think it was meeting my partner and just realizing that there's a bigger life out there waiting for you if you're brave enough to face it.
Oh, did you notice any shifts and changes, like, in your body or how you felt or how you were thinking at all?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that I was really enjoying my food. really enjoying it. My body did change. I did gain weight, which is really hard as a dancer to watch your body gain weight. But after a couple of years, it began to settle down again. I think it was probably holding on to all of those incredible foods for the first couple of years, maybe in fear that it wasn't going to see it again. But my body did settle down after a couple of years, and I'm very comfortable with my body now. It's not what it was when I was restricting. It's not what it was when I was a full-time dancer, but I am very grateful for my body now.
That's wonderful. And I know that's everyone's fear, is my body is going to change. I don't want to deal with that. But I'm wondering too, has your definition of what's a healthy body changed? Like in terms of, because before it was like, oh, I'm trying to prevent heart disease or cancer. Has that fear gone away, or like, where are you at with that now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think what's been really interesting is that when I work with people now in eating disorders, the challenge that they find hardest is making peace with their body, but making peace with food actually ends up being the easier thing. It's been the opposite for me. The food noise for me, those fears, they've never gone, but I do it anyway, because for me, a healthier body, it's not just about being physically healthy. It's about being spiritually healthy. It's about being emotionally healthy and mentally healthy. So I've actually made peace with my body changing. I would like to say that I am body confident, absolutely appreciate my body. The thoughts about food every time I eat an animal product are still there, but I eat it anyway, and that's the difference. Yeah, for me personally, the food noise hasn't really gone, but I do it anyway.
Okay. Thank you for being honest about that, because I think people do wonder if there's lingering thoughts or struggles. And certainly it is a process, right? And things do take time to resolve and recover. I'm wondering too, because certainly people ask me all the time, I'm wondering if you get asked these questions, like, how can it be healthy to eat like things with certain seed oils or preservatives or red meat or things? Like, people will ask me, like, why would you support that or encourage that? Like, why is that necessary? Like, how is it not more quote unquote healthy to eat all these clean foods that don't have all these things? Like, why wouldn't my body be healthier if I'm doing that? And so I'm wondering what you would say to someone who's maybe listening or asks you that.
It's the bigger picture. I believe that all food has a place in our diet, all food. Some foods are better for us nutritionally, and some foods are just good for our soul. And there is so much more to what we put on our bodies than just our physical health. Like I say, it's our emotional health and our spiritual health. And you don't experience that whilst you're restricting. There's always going to be a rough relationship with something or somebody whilst you're restricting, and to be able to open up the doors to a huge life beyond what you could even imagine is by allowing all foods in and listening to your body. Because when we're saying eat all foods, we're not saying eat pizza and donuts every day. Like, your body will say to you, thanks for giving me these fun foods, but if I eat these every single day, I'm not going to feel good. And it is communicating with us. We're not saying eat unhealthily. We're not saying eat healthily. We're saying eat everything, allow everything in your diet, and your body will start talking to you, and it will start saying, I think I want more of this, and I think I want a little bit less of this. And it's magical like that. It won't allow us to always eat unhealthy food. So trust your body. It's incredible.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I think that is the hardest thing to really like take in and believe, especially if people maybe listening or thinking about going into treatment or thinking about seeking help. It's so scary to think that's not possible. Like, how can I do that? Because especially if you've been doing it for so long, it's like, wait, these rules and the way I've been going about life, like, how can I change?
Yeah, when it's so deeply embedded. And I think the most important thing when you go into treatment is finding somebody, and that might mean moving around a few different therapists, coaches, whoever you're working with, find somebody that you can really build a relationship with, that you can be honest with, and you know that you can trust and actually hears you and doesn't just talk to you from a textbook.
So I'm curious, you know, you do the coaching. Do people come to you knowing ahead of time, like having an idea that they have some disordered eating or an eating disorder, or is that something that maybe they're not aware of and it comes to fruition during the time you're working with them?
No, they come to me knowing that they have an eating disorder. Unfortunately, like, our NHS in the UK are absolutely incredible with the resources and the funding that they have, but we have very little resources and funding, and so few money is put into mental health issues, especially eating disorders. Like, we're at the bottom of the pile. And so the treatment that our NHS can offer is so short-lived, and really, it's only CBT. There's not a lot more outside of that, and it's either 10 or 20 sessions. And that's going to work for so few people. And I work with them either alongside their treatment under the NHS, or I work with them instead of, and then we get other people on board, like dietitians and therapists as well. But yes, they do know that they're living with disordered eating, at least.
Okay. So I know I'm in the States and you're over there, but do you primarily work with people in the UK then?
I do, but I can work with anybody anywhere. Eating disorders don't discriminate, no matter what country you're from, what race you are. Yeah, so we'll work with anybody.
Okay. So if people did want to reach out to you, or you obviously are on social media, which is how I found you, and I was so inspired to get you on. So thank you for being here. How can they find you?
Yeah. So either on Instagram, which is Light Minds Collective, or my website, which is lightmindscollective.com, or on LinkedIn, I'd say that's Zoe Harwood. That's where I'm most active, is those three.
Awesome. Zoe, thank you for sharing and being so vulnerable. And I'm so glad that, like, you turned things around for yourself, because I know it's really difficult and a lot of people struggle to do that. So it's really inspiring to hear your story.
Thank you. And thank you for giving orthorexia a voice, because it's not spoken about, and it is normalized as wellness. So thank you for that.
Of course. Any last final words before we end?
Don't be afraid to reach out. If there is any doubt in your mind that you may have a disordered relationship with food, if restriction and rules and rigidity is in your mind somewhere, just be curious. It may not necessarily mean that you need treatment. It might mean that you just need some guidance, but always ask for help.
Wonderful. Thank you again, Zoe. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network, and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners, so if you like the show, please rate and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.